Hello, this is Paul Saunders, president of the Center for the National Interest. Welcome to the Three Questions podcast. Today, I'm going to do something a little bit unusual, which is to talk to myself, because after all, who doesn't love listening to himself talk? For those who don't know me, I've worked for about the last 30 years on Russia, U.S. policy toward Russia, U.S.-Russia relations, etc. In addition to the other topics that I'm interested in, I thought I would talk for a few minutes today about President Trump's efforts to end Russia's war in Ukraine by negotiating a peace deal. First question, President Trump just today announced that he decided to reduce his deadline for Vladimir Putin, to reduce it from 50 days to just another 10 to 12 days. Why did he do that? The answer to that, which I think is fairly apparent to most, is that President Trump is becoming increasingly frustrated with his inability to negotiate an end to the war, and especially with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He's been, Trump, fairly transparent about this, complaining that they have conversations, they talk about peace, they talk about ending the war, and then Putin launches these big missile attacks or drone attacks on Ukraine. And that has clearly been aggravating for President Trump, who thought, or at least said, that he could end the conflict quite quickly and has found, I think, a somewhat more challenging reality as he's actually tried to do that. Second question, when Trump's newly shortened deadline expires, what will happen? The first answer to that is that, you know, the president has threatened to impose what he's described as kind of very extreme tariffs on Russia. Of course, you know, actual U.S.-Russia trade at this point is fairly limited. Even before the war, U.S.-Russia trade was about one-tenth of the volume of Europe-Russia trade. And of course, since the war started, you know, it's gone only down from there. So the impact of actual, you know, tariffs on Russian exports to the United States, I think, would be quite limited. But the president has also talked about this idea of kind of secondary tariffs, you know, that there would be tariffs on other countries that are doing business with Russia. That, I suspect, is going to be, you know, considerably more challenging to implement, or at least to use as an instrument to put really significant pressure onto Russia, much more difficult than the president may think. Russia's trade now, you know, really a lot of it with China, very significant oil trade also with India, and Russia's trade generally, you know, redistributed away from Europe toward Asia, and in some cases toward the Middle East or Africa or other countries, you know, depending on the nature of the product. And, you know, one of the big challenges with secondary, quote-unquote, tariffs or secondary sanctions or sanctions generally is, you know, every economic transaction has two parties to it. So if you want to kind of inflict pain on Russia by complicating or blocking or making more expensive, you know, these transactions that it has, again, in order to punish Russia, it's not possible to do that in a way that doesn't also punish the companies and countries at the other end of those transactions. And it's unlikely that most at this point will cooperate with that again, especially because Russia's trade has really oriented away from, the United States and its allies and other countries over which the United States would have significant leverage, and toward kind of more independent players in the international system. Where China is concerned, there's already kind of a U.S.-China trade dispute underway that has settled down a little bit in recent weeks, and that's been a big relief to the stock market and to others in the United States. Is the president going to kind of risk restarting this potentially, very costly and destabilizing trade conflict with China? Is the president going to really push India, which the United States wants as a close partner in kind of balancing against China and managing, the security and economic and other interests that we have in the Indo-Pacific region? I think there are kind of many big questions around that. Another question about what happens is, what does the United States kind of do and not do in terms of supporting Ukraine when this deadline elapses? And at least at this point, it looks like the president is very prepared to allow American companies to sell weapons to Europe, with an understanding that European governments or companies would resell those weapons or gift those weapons to Ukraine. So it looks like U.S. weapon and ammunition supply to Ukraine could continue to the extent that production lines allow it. Perhaps even more consequentially, it looks at this point as if the president is prepared for the United States to continue providing intelligence and targeting support to Ukraine, without which many of the weapons systems that we might sell could be less effective. That's very important too, and certainly suggests that to the extent that Ukraine has the capability and will to keep fighting, that it can do so. A final element of, what happens next is, does Trump move on from trying to bring some end to the war in Ukraine? And if he does so, which I expect he will, does he try to work with Putin on other issues? And at this point, it looks less and less likely that the president may try to do that, because in becoming as frustrated as he's become with Putin over the talks to end the war, he seems, somewhat less likely to be interested in trying to engage with Putin in a really deep way on other things, like, for example, nuclear arms control. Third and final question for myself would be, what's the trajectory of the war look like if Trump's deadline elapses and the fighting continues and the United States, continues supplying weapons and intelligence support in the way that I described? And I guess I would say a couple of things there. First of all, it looks increasingly like a sustainable, quote-unquote, conflict, again, so long as the people of Ukraine and the government of Ukraine are willing to continue fighting. That suggests that this war could just go on and on and on, really, for quite some time. I guess the second thing I would say is, from a kind of a broad strategic perspective, I don't think this war really in its history so far has been a war that is amenable to a negotiated solution. And from my point of view, there's one fairly clear reason for that, which is actually that neither of the parties are prepared to negotiate on terms that are overlapping. The fundamental problem is that in order to get a negotiated solution to any conflict, whether it's a war or a trade dispute or, for that matter, a personal lawsuit, you got to have both sides in a situation in which each feels strong enough that it is kind of comfortable negotiating because there's no fear of making concessions that side is unprepared to make. And at the same time as they feel confident in that way, they have to feel actually sufficiently uncertain or sufficiently weak that they're willing to talk in the first place, that they see a negotiated outcome as being in their to their advantage. And so far in the war, and you have to have both parties in the same place, that in this same frame of mind, if you will, at the same time. And I think so far in this conflict, we just haven't seen that. The Russian side, in the person of Russian President Vladimir Putin, have been quite confident. And the Ukrainian side, and therefore the Russian side, hasn't really seen a need to negotiate. And the Ukrainian side, I think, has been concerned about being forced into making concessions that it's not prepared to make, you know, too weak, if you will. And this, you know, generally speaking, has been the rationale behind the idea that more European, more American, more outside support generally for Ukraine is important to getting Ukraine to a place where it's willing to negotiate. And conversely, that making the war sort of harder for Russia to fight could make Russia more willing to negotiate by reducing its long-term confidence. But that hasn't worked. And at this point, the two sides, generally speaking, seem prepared to keep fighting, which, you know, ultimately means kind of to roll the dice. Can we get a better deal, quote unquote, in the future than we can get now? And as long as the two sides are prepared to roll the dice in that way, then the war continues. And, you know, we find out a year from now, 2 years from now, you know, 5 years from now, who knows what the ultimate resolution is. And it's just a long-term, bloody, destructive war of attrition. And I think many would have concerns about the Ukraine's sort of relative ability to sustain a conflict like that, because it is, you know, a smaller country with a smaller population with fewer resources than Russia. And I think that for many would raise sort of longer term questions about where the war may end. But at least for the time being, if the president's deadline expires and he gives up on this effort, and everybody has found sort of a, at least for now, a sustainable approach to continuing the war, then I think that's the question that will be tested, and that's the question that will define the outcome. How long is Ukraine able to keep fighting? So thank you very much for joining me today on Three Questions. Again, this is Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest. If you enjoy the podcast, I encourage you strongly to share it and also to subscribe on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or even just look up the RSS feed. Thanks very much. Have a good day.